Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Aimé Israel Pelletier, professor and head of French at the University of Texas at Arlington. She is the author of the new book, On the Mediterranean and the Nile, The Jews of Egypt, published by Indiana University Press in 2018. Aimé, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, first question, how did you come to write this book?
So I wrote this book, first of all, to figure out, to understand how Egyptian Jews living at a time of high nationalism around the 1950s and who were branded by Nasser as foreigners, enemies of the state, how these Jews thought of their identity. In other words, how they imagined their collective identity. I wanted to also understand how they processed the changes taking place in Egypt in the first half of the 20th century. What it was like for them, right, born and raised in Egypt, to feel that suddenly, like Moses felt, or so we're told, that they were foreigners in a foreign land. So I started there. I was born in Egypt, as were my parents and grandparents. And so listening to family and other Egyptian Jews describe what it was like to be a Jew in Egypt at that time, relying on my own memories and reading memoirs of individual experiences, I was able to piece together a general but obviously incomplete picture. So with this book, I wanted to draw a fuller picture, give it more context, and if I can add this too, I wanted to address the claims made by some historians and other people, both in the U.S. and in Egypt, in the 1970s and 80s, that the Jews in Egypt were foreign elements who came to the country to enrich themselves. Basically, they were opportunistic. They sided with the colonial power, with the British against Egypt, that they had shallow roots and didn't think of themselves as Egyptians. So these claims, as I argue in the introduction of my book, and I illustrate throughout the book, have relied on nationalist, anti-Zionist, and frankly, anti-Semitic narratives to advance this view. So what I try to do in my book is to bring to the fore, right, and to interrogate the writings of Egyptian Jews who actually lived through the crisis, lived through the sea change from liberalism to Arab nationalism. So I show in the book, I hope to have shown in the book, that Egyptian Jews were connected to Egypt by the bonds of history and of geography, their biblical past, and by their attachment to the culture, both Arab and cosmopolitan. Their attachment to the people, the food, the language, the music, sights and smells, and the landscape of Egypt. My book also makes the point that their identity as Egyptians relies on an image that was formulated in the 1920s by what are often called Egyptian territorial nationalists by historians, and that was reflected also in the politics of the Waft movement. And what they did was that they saw, as they tried to define the Egyptian character and identity, they saw Egypt as unique in the region, looked to its glorious pharaonic past to construct its identity. And that was after the independence, Egypt's independence from the Ottoman Empire, and at least initially its independence from British rule. So they tried to construct a Mediterranean and Nilotic identity. And the Jews felt comfortable with this definition of the new Egypt. I could add some here and to say what I feel my role is, perhaps, in treating that subject.
Yep, go ahead.
The Jewish community in Egypt was a very small minority among many minorities. At its peak, right, in the 1940s, it numbered around 80,000. Today, there are fewer than 15 permanent residents. None of them are children. And the youngest, Magda Harun, the president of the Jewish community, is in her late 60s. Now, at one time, it was a vibrant and influential community, and it has, for all intents and purposes, vanished. It leaves behind priceless artifacts, synagogues. Some date back to the 12th century. They leave behind the community's registers and the second oldest Jewish cemetery in the world, the 9th century Basatin cemetery. All are in disrepair. Indications are that a few synagogues are receiving the protection of the Egyptian government, and some have been allowed to undergo restoration. So I consider my work, humbly obviously, as part of this restorative project, making known this community's rich intellectual, literary, and cultural production, both past and ongoing.
Well, we might delve into more of the substance of your book chapter by chapter. So your book's divided into 5 chapters, each covering a particular Egyptian Jewish writer. So you start with Jacques Hassoun. Tell us about him.
So as you said, the first chapter of my book opens with Jacques Hassoun because in a real sense, he spearheaded the movement in France that gave the Egyptian Jewish diaspora a sense of itself as a distinct community with a distinct history. He helped shape the narrative. He made explicit that narrative, the relation between Egyptian Jews and Egyptian Arab culture, so that Jewish-Egyptian identity becomes, in fact, inseparable from Egyptian identity, not only back to biblical times, but also, and importantly, transnationally, over the border, into the present, making it in a way transportable in France, Israel, and elsewhere. Because as he believed, and as he put it, and I quote him here, "I am Jewish because I am Egyptian. I am Egyptian because I am Jewish." What makes Hassoun's work compelling is that he hones in on this essential relation between Jews and Egypt that is renewed from generation to generation. So who is Jacques Hassoun, right? For those who don't know him or haven't heard of him, he was a French psychoanalyst and a militant whose clinical practice focused on immigrant children and on children born in France to immigrant parents, not only from Egypt, but also from North Africa, Eastern Europe, and even transplants from the French countryside who'd migrated to Paris. In Egypt, Hassoun was imprisoned and expelled without his family. He was 18 years old, accused of communist activity. In France, he studied medicine in Montpellier and was active in several political organizations, including the Communist Party, which he didn't stick with for long. In May 68, he joined the revolution and was instrumental in successful efforts to reform medical training in hospitals. He also led the charge to provide free psychological services in schools to young children, as well as in poor neighborhoods. So I was interested also, apart from this magnificent, bio, there was what really drew me was that he was one of the first, really, to organize a return to Egypt. He led groups to Cairo and to Alexandria starting in 1979, when relations between Israel and Egypt were on the right footing at the time. And he led these groups until his death in 1999 at the young age of 63. Some people on the trip were returning to an Egypt they remembered. Others had left young and remembered little or nothing at all, and still others had only heard about Egypt from parents and grandparents and were seeing it for the first time. So while in Egypt, he took the group around and reported what he saw. And what he saw was what was most disturbing in what he saw was the disappearance of what he calls the erasure of Jewish presence, so that every trip back was made with the expressed purpose of, and I use his word here, restoring the connection between Jews and Egypt. So in the chapter, I also go over his work on identity, memory, transmission, and language. I won't go through all of this here, but just to take maybe a few, his concept of identity. The issue of one's identity, says Hassoun, comes into play, raises its head, and looms in fact large only, or usually only, in times of crisis. That time, and I quote, when we're asked to identify ourselves, to state who we are. In other words, the identity question is the harbinger of a crisis. Identity is not important until it is, and it often is, so we must be prepared at all times to confront it. So that's his take on identity. And the way we prepare ourselves, according to Hassoun, the way we defend ourselves against this looming threat or ambush is by passing on to our descendants our heritage. He calls this act of self-defense transmission, la transmission. Transmission consists in the knowledge and experience or experiences that we pass on to others. Without it, individuals and communities are at risk of disappearing from history. His observations in clinical practice led him to believe that the most vulnerable children, and by extension, the most vulnerable communities, were those who didn't know their family history. So but let's keep in mind, Hassoun adds, that the only way that transmission succeeds is by keeping its content open to interpretation and modification. Modification and interpretation by those who follow us, right? So transmission is a mechanism. It's also a drive designed to meet the needs of the individuals who receive it and who in turn will pass it on to others. This open feature of transmission accommodates both conscious and unconscious input. We don't always know what we pass on, he says, right? What has migrated along with our stories about ourselves and about the past. We have smuggled, he says, knowingly and unknowingly features of our past and of pasts before us. And that's how transmission becomes effective. I'd like to touch on one more idea on Hassoun, if I might. And it's the question of the language or the languages that we use when we have more than one at our disposal. Hassoun knew three languages. He spoke Arabic, and he could write it. French, he wrote brilliantly and spoke flawlessly. He had, as many who knew him say, he had a way with words, and I can absolutely agree that he also has an exquisite style. He also knew Hebrew and read Hebrew. I believe he also wrote it. So about language, Hassoun argues that when we ask ourselves, to what language do I belong? What is my native language? We're actually asking a loaded question, a question filled with traps, both politically motivated and self-inflicted traps. It's not only a complicated question, and a question that many like him feel the pressure to answer for themselves and to answer for others, but it's also a bad or a wrong question. Because the way he defines language, or the way he sees it, is that language is plural. It's not just in our words, right? It's in our gestures as well. He saw in his clinical practice that the choice of what language to use and when to use it was fraught with anxiety. Some individuals were so stuck on a language that the very thought of speaking another language made them silent, made them suffer. So in his work, he advocates for a less passionate investment in the languages we use. It seems odd, but he includes in that the mother tongue or what passes for it. There is nothing that special about the mother tongue. In passing, if I may add, if we have time, I also point out in this chapter that Hassoun's relationship to French, the French language, right, differs from that of Maghrebi French writers like Abdelkabir Hatibi, with whom he had a long and interesting correspondence, and Tahar Ben Jaloun, for example, for whom the trauma of French colonialism is traceable in what they say about it and how they write. For Hassoun, on the other hand, even though French imposed itself imperially on him, he was able to imagine himself overpowering it with his style, doing with it what he wished. So, and then finally, I will say this word. I think Hassoun's work needs far more attention than I was able to give it in the book. For one thing, it really needs to be translated and added to the corpus of Jewish studies. It most definitely belongs there and would add a very important facet to it. So that's about Jacques Hassoun.
So in your next chapter, you discuss Jacqueline Kahanoff. Tell us what you mean by Kahanoffian Levantinism.
I'm sorry, you broke up.
So in your next chapter, you discuss Jacqueline Kahanoff. So if you could tell us a bit about what you mean by Kahanoffian Levantinism.
I lay out the origin of the idea of Kahanoff's Levantinism and in the book, and I use in particular the novel Jacob's Ladder to show that even in 1951, when she was writing or when the book was published, she interrogated what was meant by that term. That term, of course, had a pejorative meaning in the past before Kahanov and others as well. But the pejorative meaning was defined Levantinism as a Levantine person, as a mix, as a mongrel, a person who took on Western and Oriental customs and values and performed them poorly, right? So that in the end, he was ridiculous. The Levantine was ridiculous, corrupt, and dangerous to the so-called pure or idealized or homogeneous culture he used to forge this identity. Now, what Kahanov does is to give us a positive turn to this, but to not do it in a simplistic way. For example, I think even though it's true to say that for Kahanov, Levantinism offers a different way of, or acknowledges a way of living together and celebrating differences and celebrating our capacity to borrow from each other. It is that, but it is also my reading of her idea is that it is also more complicated and more knowing than simply that. So what I argue is that rather than a theory that foresees, you know, or foreshadows the reality of intersectionality, Kahanov's Levantinism acknowledges first and foremost that ethnic, religious, and cultural differences are deeply rooted and they are indissoluble and they are private, which doesn't mean that they can't be shared in public, but that doing so could be risky. So she offers, what she offers in her Levantinism, the way I understand it, is that it's an aesthetics far more than it is a system, right? A way, it is a way of doing things. It's an arrangement, a way of preserving one's difference, one's ethnic particularities and such, while entertaining or hosting those of others. So another way of putting it, Kahanov's flavor of Levantinism addresses others in their difference, establishes the importance of rootedness in community, and protects the separation of public and private, while at the same time encouraging open, neutral, and let's put it this way, decentered relational activities in the public sphere. So again, for me, as I read it, her Levantinism is an aesthetics, an always provisional, personal, and experimental practice.
So in chapter 3, you discuss Edmund Jabez and his monumental Book of Questions. Tell us about this.
So many readers took Jabez's The Book of Questions as highlighting Holocaust suffering, right? That he spoke principally in this book of several volumes on the Holocaust or of the Holocaust. But Jabez, I argue, makes clear, both in the work itself and in interviews, that the Book of Questions highlights his own suffering and the suffering of his compatriots. And because to be Jewish is to be Egyptian, the Book of Questions is about the suffering in exile of all Jews. And that, of course, includes Jews during the Holocaust, of the Holocaust. So references to Egypt and to his compatriots, I argue in the book, occupies a significant place in this work and in his subsequent works, where he asserts his belongingness and his attachment to Egypt, to the Nile, to the desert, and to the Mediterranean. Did I answer your question?
You could either tell us a bit more about Edmund Jabez, or if you want to, we can move on to the next chapter.
I could add about Jabez, and it's a idea that I treat in the book and that I find very important because it is confirmed by other writers, and that's French anti-Semitism and his experience of it in France. I make a point of focusing attention on what he says about France in the Book of Hospitality. Actually, his very last book, it was published posthumously, where he makes a really moving tribute to the hospitality of Arab and Mediterranean peoples and sets that against the inhospitality of the French. So I wanted to say that. His experience in France, like the experience of many refugees who came to France, was a difficult one, was a poor one, a disappointing one. And we could move on to Paul Ajac, maybe?
Yeah, sure.
Paul Ajac wrote 11 novels to date, and the first 10 focused entirely on the Jewish bourgeoisie, mostly urban, and in Egypt, right, as it processes the political sea change from a liberal cosmopolitan Egypt to one who's turned its back on the Jewish community. The 10 novels are on that subject. Jacques is an extraordinary writer, really, evocative and lively. Her characters, both Jewish and Muslim, are not inclined to stop the action and meditate. So we see them on the move and often disruptive. And she analyzes these characters with a broad brush and a great deal of humor and warmth and truth. And yet we come to know them very well, inside and out. Her narratives describe their everyday lives in Egypt, in France, and in Israel. We see them dealing with difficult circumstances in France and Israel, for example. Many of them, hear for the first time about the Holocaust. Her characters, right? And kind of resent the fact that the Holocaust has risked or eclipses their own suffering. So Jacques doesn't often show her characters in the best light, far from that. But that is to say that her novels and her characters are complex. They have human interest and a truth value. And so I recommend them, and I recommend that they too be translated. So far, only one has. I argue in the book that her novels that are written in French, right, and for a broad French public, are works of resistance constructed against a dominant narrative, the dominant narrative of perpetual Jewish exile and wandering. Because what she does successfully is to not only re-inscribe Jewish memory back into Egyptian history, but she inscribes forward into French culture the Egyptian Jewish community. She plants its ethnographical imprint, so to speak, in the soil of France, this way ensuring their survival transnationally. I can say that she was born in 1949 in Cairo, and that she's a novelist, as I just explained, a journalist, and a radio producer. She lives, actually, she's a radio personality, and lives in Paris. Apart from that, only that she lived in Israel, that when upon leaving Egypt in 1957, she lived on a kibbutz and was separated from her mother, who was trying to find an arrangement before she could bring her and her brothers to Paris.
So,
can I answer any questions?
So I think that we're just about out of time with the interview. So there is one last chapter that we didn't quite get to talk about. So listeners will have to pick up your book if they want to find out a bit more. But thanks for giving us such a fantastic and intriguing overview of some of these, I think, not so known figures, at least in the English language world. Before we let you go, can we ask you a little bit about what you're working on next?
Sure. So I'm continuing with a second volume of On the Mediterranean and the Nile that looks at Egyptian Jewish writers transnationally as they continue to draw on the Egyptian experience. In the past, I avoided working from translations. I'm now ready to take the leap. I want to explore in depth Israeli writers like Orly Castel-Bloom and the late Ronit Matalon. And of course, the Francophone material is keeping me busy at the moment.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like a really great continuation of this project. And we certainly hope to have you back on New Books in Jewish Studies to discuss that after it's published. So thanks very much for being on the program. So you've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies with your host, Max Kaiser. And with us today, we had M.A. Israel Pelletier, professor and head of French at the University of Texas at Arlington. She talked to us about her new book, On the Mediterranean and the Nile, The Jews of Egypt, published by Indiana University Press in 2018. Thanks for listening.